Welcome to Good News in the Morning, a program of words and music, bringing a Christian message of hope and encouragement to those who are looking for an intelligent, meaningful, and spirited approach to faith and to life.
Today, I choose to follow you. Today, I choose to give my yes to you. Today, I choose to hear your voice and live. Today, I choose to follow you.
Good morning. You're listening to CFRA Radio. The show is Good News in the Morning, and this show is put on by Good News Christian Ministries, Post Office Box 184, Rideau Ferry, Ontario, K0G1W0. If you Google our webpage, Good News Christian Ministries, you'll see past broadcasts, newsletters, all sorts of really helpful things to help you grow. My name's George Sinclair. I'm the pastor of Church of the Messiah in Ottawa, and it's my privilege and honor to spend some time with you this morning to open the Bible and to talk about Jesus. And so while we listen to this first song, get your Bibles out, maybe get a cup of coffee or tea or something like that, and we're going to listen to the Wren Collective Experiment sing Praise Like Fireworks. Good morning again. You're listening to CFRA Radio. The show is Good News in the Morning, put on by Good News Christian Ministries, Post Office Box 184, Rideau Ferry, Ontario, K0G1W0. Just Google Good News Christian Ministries to see our webpage. Just so you know, this show is completely supported by your prayer and financial generosity. If you can help us in one or both of those, it'll be greatly appreciated. My name's George Sinclair. I'm the pastor of Church of the Messiah in Ottawa, and here's the question for today. Jesus, Buddha, and Muhammad go for a walk. That's not the beginning of a joke. And some of you are worried that maybe thinking, oh gosh, here we have an Anglican talking, who knows what on earth he's going to say. But the story that we're going to look at in the Bible today is a really interesting story that if we were to imagine Jesus, Buddha, and Muhammad going on a walk together, it actually sort of helps to show us the differences between these three historical figures who started three important faiths or ways. So we're going to look at Luke chapter 9, verses 51 to 56. Luke chapter 9, verse 51 to 56, and here's how it goes. When the days drew near for Jesus to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead of him who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. But the people did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. And when his disciples, James and John, saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But Jesus turned and rebuked them, and they went on to another village. As we prepare to think about that, we're going to listen to Brooke Fraser sing him. Hello again. I sort of asked this sort of challenging question or curious question. Jesus, Buddha, and Muhammad go for a walk. I, of course, know that the three of them never did go for a walk. All three of them are historical figures, probably. Gautama Buddha probably died almost 500 years before the birth of Jesus. And, of course, Muhammad was born about 570 years after the birth of Jesus, or 5.5 centuries after the death of Jesus, approximately. So obviously the three of them could never have gone for a walk. But it's sort of an interesting question. And this text, which I just read, and maybe I'll just read it again in a moment, if we think about it for a second and imagine that these three characters going for a walk together and listening to James and John speak, it's actually maybe very instructive to help us think a little bit about the difference between the ways that these three different people started, the way that Jesus started or taught or opened, the way that Buddha taught or opened, the way that Muhammad taught or opened. So, you know, listen to the story again. And here's how it goes. Once again, one of the things that we Christians have a problem with is, it's one of my themes lately, I guess, is that we read itsy-bitsy bits of the Bible, and we sort of pull out, and sometimes ministers unconsciously encourage this by just, you know, throwing out a whole pile of little Bible snippets. And so we can lose sight of the fact that, if you're reading Philippians, you're reading a letter that has a beginning. If you ever write, you know, it's very old-fashioned to write letters. But, you know, if you can remember when, or you've heard stories about when people wrote letters, it has a beginning, middle, has an end. And stories, we all still read stories or watch movies, which are a form of story, and has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so Luke is writing the true story of Jesus. And he's done lots of historical research. He's talked to lots of witnesses, and he's telling the true story of Jesus to a pagan who for some reason is interested in Jesus. So Luke is writing a story. And some of you, if you're a little bit familiar with the Bible, you might have noticed if you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's a lot of things which are similar in them, but they seem to be not quite written the same way. They're all sort of mixed up. Like if you have a red letter Bible and you read the Gospel of Matthew, for instance, you'll see that you'll have like pages and pages where it's like all black and virtually no red, and then all of a sudden you'll have pages and pages of red with virtually no black, and then it'll go back to black with hardly any red, and then all red. And that's because Matthew chose, when he was telling the true story of Jesus, to sort of group the teaching sections of Jesus together. You know, and that's just the way Matthew thought that would be sort of a good way to communicate the true story of Jesus. Mark had his own particular thing. I'm not talking today about how the three Gospels are organized, but one of the things that Luke does, the way Luke tells his story, is organize it by, in a sense, destinations. And so Luke chapter 9, verse 51 is, if you're reading the Gospel of Luke from beginning to end, which is a really useful thing to do some afternoon or some day, is just take the Gospel of Luke and just read it as you would a novel, from the beginning to the end. And if you read the Gospel of Luke from the beginning to the end, you'll notice that Luke chapter 9, verse 51, what we're reading today, is a significant turning point in the Gospel of Luke. That just before this, the disciples have come to acknowledge the identity of Jesus, that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And now here in 951, Jesus, how does it go? How does it go again, 951? When the days drew near for him to be taken up, I'll talk about that in a moment. It's talking about both the death of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus and the ascension of Jesus, and it links all three of them tightly together with this simple little phrase, taken up. But when the days drew near for Jesus to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And just before I read any further, so if you're reading the Gospel of Luke, everything now from 951 on till he gets to Jerusalem in somewhere in chapter 19, every single thing that we read, we have to read in light of the fact that Jesus is saying and doing everything, mindful of the fact that he's going to Jerusalem to die. Okay? I mean, every single thing that we see in the Gospel of Luke from 951 on to 19 is mindful of the fact that Jesus is going to Jerusalem specifically to die, and then, I believe, to rise from the dead and to ascend into heaven. And so we have to read it in light of that. And so, once again, imagine Jesus, Buddha, and Muhammad are going for a walk. And they're all walking along, and they know that Jesus has set his face to go to Jerusalem He's going to be taken up. He's going to die. He's going to rise from the dead. He's going to ascend to heaven. And verse 52, and Jesus sent messengers ahead of him who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. But the people did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. And when his disciples James and John saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them. And they went on to another village. Now, how do you imagine that Buddha or Muhammad would comment about this whole story? See, here's where the story gets interesting. Now, here's probably what Buddha would say. Buddha would say, yeah, Jesus, you're completely right. You don't bring down fire from heaven, and you're right to tell James and John not to call down fire from heaven. But then Buddha would say, but Jesus, you're completely mistaken to go to Jerusalem to die. Like, you should not be going to Jerusalem to suffer and die. Jesus, don't you understand and realize that suffering is precisely the problem? If you would just listen to me, I will tell you the way to lose all of the desire which is at the root, the human desire, which is at the very root of all suffering. And I will show you through my meditative techniques and through my other aspects of my path and through my way that not only that you should lose all desire so that you will lose suffering, but part of the way I'll tell you to lose desire is that your whole idea that you're a you and that there are other things and that you're fundamentally different and that people are fundamentally different, like that's all mistaken. It's a type of an illusion, Jesus, and you need to learn through some practices and through my meditation that I can teach you to see, in a sense, this everything which is nothing, and to lose all desire, and by losing all desire to stop suffering, and to be at one with that which is everything, to be at one with one, just be at one. And so Jesus, you don't go to suffer. You don't actually literally go to suffer. That's probably what Buddha would say. Muhammad would say something a little bit different. He'd say, Jesus, you have the power. Your disciples have the power to call down fire from heaven. Jesus, don't tell them not to call down fire from heaven. They should call down fire from heaven on these guys. Now, I'm not saying bad things about Muhammad. If you know anything about Muhammad, Muhammad was a warrior. Muhammad was a warrior. He conquered places. You see, Muhammad would say to Jesus, Jesus, you are the second greatest prophet after me that has ever been on the planet. And it is beneath the dignity of a prophet as great as you to suffer and die. It is beneath the dignity of a prophet like you that you would let uncouth pagans grab you and kill you in a way which is shameful. And people have to know the presence of Allah, and they need to have his rule and his order. They need to have a respect for him, and they need to have a respect not only for his most preeminent prophet, which would be Muhammad, according to Muhammad, but also those lesser prophets, especially one like you. So bring down fire from heaven. Jesus, bring down fire from heaven. And these people need to learn to have a proper due reverence and respect for Allah and Allah's ways and Allah's order. Now, what would Jesus maybe say to them? Well, here's, I think, what's going on in the story. Jesus is not going to Jerusalem to bring judgment, doom, and death to others. He goes to Jerusalem to bear the judgment, doom, and death of others in himself. You catch that? That's what the whole point is of the Jesus setting his face towards Jerusalem to be taken up, to be rejected, to suffer, to die upon the cross, then to be resurrected and ascended. He's going to suffer and die. Jesus is not going to Jerusalem to bring judgment, doom, and death to others. But he goes to Jerusalem to bear the judgment, doom, and death of others in himself. This is what Jesus is doing. This is what he would say to them. Now, you know, even if some of you might debate or, I don't know, send emails or something as to whether or not I've accurately characterized the different three views, and maybe I haven't been completely accurate, but here's a very important thing for us to understand, especially those who are Christians. Even if I've accurately described each of these things, just to accurately describe something isn't actually a refutation. It's a very, very standard thing in logic that to actually describe something isn't a refutation. All you've done is describe something. And actually, even after this description, some of you who are listening to this, you might say, well, you know, George, after listening to your explanation, I actually still think that Muhammad was right. Like, you know, come on, George, like, you know, people have to know Allah's way. This whole idea of order and control and sovereignty and a proper place and living under the authority of God and having everything sort of spelled out, that's deeply attractive to many people. And they find this aspect of Jesus' death, they find it puzzling. And so there are many people who just the mere idea of order and of power and of that type of control is deeply attractive, and they're puzzled by Jesus' answer. You know, by the same token, there are many people who, hearing this, are deeply attracted to Buddha's answer and Buddha's way. Like, I'm not saying that Buddhism is only for depressed people. I'm not saying that at all. Not, okay, just get that out of your mind. But I'm just trying to use that as a way for us to maybe emotionally appreciate the attraction of the Buddhist way. I mean, when I struggle with depression at different times in my life, one of the things that characterizes me when I'm struggling with depression or when I'm struggling with deep stress, a lot of stress, is that I'll have the desire. I don't like what I'm struggling with. I don't like dealing with failure, and I just wish I could sleep and not wake up. That I could just go to bed and sleep and not wake up. And that's a very, very deep desire for a lot of people. And many people live long periods of their life like that. Now, I'm not saying that Buddhism is just for people who are depressed, but we can sort of get a bit of a sense that the idea that losing desire and not suffering, that's in fact a powerful attraction. And so if that's powerfully attractive to us, then we can see how the words of Jesus are going to sound puzzling. But here's what I'd like to say to you is just consider once again, look a little bit more deeply into this. Remember, Jesus is not going to Jerusalem to bring judgment, doom, and death to others, but he goes to Jerusalem to bear the judgment, doom, and death of others in himself. And the Christian teaching is that Jesus is going to Jerusalem to be taken up, that it's not just that he's going to die this death, but that the resurrection of Jesus is the vindication of Jesus' message and his mission. You see, I would say that if you actually were to look at the evidence, look at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, that there is compelling reasons to believe that Jesus actually did rise from the dead. And if Jesus rose from the dead, that vindicates the Gospel of Luke. It vindicates the message of Jesus. It vindicates what Jesus does on the cross. It vindicates the idea that when Jesus says that his death upon the cross is going to accomplish this, that his death upon the cross is actually going to be a death that is an act of substitution and exchange, that he will substitute himself for you and me, and that he will bear my death, my doom, my judgment in himself, and in exchange he will offer his perfect standing before the Father, that this message of Jesus is vindicated by the resurrection of Jesus. And the resurrection of Jesus, with all apologies to Al Gore, is the true inconvenient truth. It is the true inconvenient truth. Because if Jesus is risen from the dead, Buddhism cannot be correct. If Jesus has risen from the dead, Islam, Muhammad, cannot be correct. With all due respect, I mean no slight to anybody at all. I really don't. The resurrection of Jesus is the inconvenient truth. And it's also the great promise. Because, you know, as much as I might like to fall asleep and never wake up, as much as I might like to see order imposed, the fact of the matter is that the deep things about a desire for truth and the knowledge that what I really need is I need to be loved for who I am and to dwell in love and experience love and to receive love and to give love and the resurrection of Jesus is not only the vindication of Jesus, it's the promise that by putting our faith and trust in Jesus and being with him, that we also, clothed in the righteousness of Christ, will be remade in new resurrection bodies for the new heaven and the new earth. It's the promise that love is deeper than death, that this idea that I was made for love and should dwell in love, that I was made for truth and should dwell in truth, that I was made for God, that this idea that I am myself an illusion, that order can just be imposed on me, my whole desire for freedom and for love and for truth and for beauty is completely and utterly, it's shown to be true desires by the resurrection of Jesus, following his doom, death, judgment, bearing death upon the cross. That's what it shows. That's the profound attraction of the person and the work of Jesus. And so, I guess, you know, friends, here's what I would just, you know, say to you. It's, there's no time better than today to begin either a journey of asking, of knowing more about Jesus and discovering whether he really is who he says he is. There's no better time than right now as you listen to this. There's no better time than right now. It won't be better when you're retired or made more money or got more degrees or had more kids. There's no better time than right now to say to Jesus, Jesus, I desire to know you. I desire to know if you're true. I desire to know if you're real. And if you are true and if you are real, please just draw me to yourself. And I don't want to be pursuing anything that's not true, that's not real. Jesus, take me as your own. In your mercy, take me as your own and reveal yourself to me. And for us who are Christians, it's always good to pray that God will grow within us a humble, trusting knowledge of the greatness of Jesus to save me completely, fully, immediately, eternally, and perfectly. See, that's what Jesus does. When we put our faith and trust in him, when we turn from anything which is not him and just put our faith and trust in him and what he did for us on the cross, he saves us completely, fully, immediately, eternally, and perfectly. And so we can pray, dear God, please grow in me a humble, trusting knowledge of the greatness of Jesus to save me completely, fully, immediately, eternally, and perfectly. Friends, I hope you pray this prayer. In closing, let's listen to George Beverly Shea sing, Have Thine Own Way.
Have thine own way, Lord, have thine own way. Thou art the potter, I am the clay. Mold me and make me after thy will. While I am waiting, yielded and still. Have thine own way, Lord, have thine own way. Hold o'er my being absolute sway. Fill with thy spirit till all shall see Christ only, always living in me. Have thine own way. Search me and try me, Master, today. Whiter than snow, Lord, wash me just now, as in thy presence.
Good News in the Morning is produced in the studios of News Talk Radio.